Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At the peak of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, Hillary Clinton railed against a vast right-wing conspiracy, one that was out, she said, to bring down her husband, the president. But two wings can play that game, says our guest tonight. And now, he says, there is a powerful new alliance on the left. It tried to defeat George W. Bush in 2004. It failed, but there is more to come. Tonight on Point, National Review correspondent Byron York's vision of a vast left-wing conspiracy. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where today House Speaker Dennis Hastert, in effect, told Republicans to retreat in their battle with Democrats and let an ethics committee probe of Majority Leader Tom DeLay move forward. This would mean reversing some of the rules changes on ethics passed in the House in January by Republicans. Just yesterday, President Bush praised DeLay and gave him a ride on Air Force One. John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal and joins me now. John, good to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on with the Republicans and the Ethics Committee rules? They got aggressive. They're retreating. Why?
They're retreating because they're feeling the heat. Tom DeLay has been a major distraction from the Republican agenda. And until they could move forward with this ethics process, they couldn't get past the DeLay story. And so what we've seen is two things happening at the same time. One, the president has stepped up and begun to defend DeLay, rode with him on Air Force One yesterday, appeared with him in Galveston at a Social Security event, and the Republicans in Washington saying, well, we're going to jumpstart the ethics process and put the Tom DeLay situation in the hands of the Ethics Committee, which, if it works the way it's done in the past, will take it a bit out of the headlines because the Ethics Committee will take some time to explore the various allegations against him.
They'll go off and do their work. John, remind us of the changes made in January that made it impossible for this investigation to go ahead.
Essentially, the changes that the Republicans made ensured that unless you had support from Republicans, Democrats could not sustain or initiate an ethics investigation, and that they would that complaints would in effect lapse. And under the old rules, you didn't necessarily need someone in the other party to go forward with an ethics complaint. And they've instituted rules that in effect raised the bar, made it more difficult to get it started. And now they're saying because Democrats have prevented the committee from organizing, and at the same time you've had the DeLay controversy, Denny Hastert and the Republicans are saying, okay, we'll go back to the way it operated before and get underway with a DeLay investigation.
And remind us of the heart of the controversy surrounding Tom DeLay on ethics terms. Is it enough to bring him down?
That's not clear. Tom DeLay's problems in Washington, as opposed to Texas, there's a grand jury investigation, as you know, in Texas,
in Austin,
of
yes.
campaign finance-related activities. In Washington, the charges have to do with overseas trips that he's taken and the financing of those trips. Many members of Congress take travel on the dime of other interests, of corporations, trade associations. You're not allowed to travel at the expense of registered lobbyists or registered foreign agents, and there are allegations that in both those cases, Tom DeLay has, in fact, taken trips that were financed by those prohibited interests.
John, where did the heat come from that turned Dennis Hastert around on this? Were the Democrats able to muster that, or was it somehow from the Republicans' own ranks?
Both. Democrats have sustained a united front in pursuing Republicans, going after Tom DeLay, keeping that in the headlines. And that, in turn, has generated heat within the Republican Party. We've seen the likes of Newt Gingrich, former Speaker, saying Tom DeLay needs to come forward and explain himself. Chris Shays, a moderate from New England, somebody probably familiar to your listeners, has said that this is hurting Republicans up for re-election next year. So it's something that the party couldn't ignore, and it was impeding other business, really. It's been dominating the headlines at a time when the president wants to move ahead on energy, on Social Security, on the budget, and he hasn't been able to do that.
How soon is this likely to be put to bed, the changes reversed and some kind of investigation up and running?
Well, the changes can be reversed quickly, and once that happens by a vote of the House, then we could see an ethics process begin. Now, typically, ethics processes, once an investigation is undertaken, it kind of goes underground for a while. That would be a good thing for Republicans because the committee recedes, does its work, doesn't issue press releases all the time, and that could have a salutary effect from the Republicans' point of view.
So many ways to skin the cat here. John, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
You bet. My pleasure.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from Silver Spring, Maryland. A few days after the 2004 presidential election, Eli Pariser, executive director of the liberal activist group MoveOn.org, sent an email to MoveOn's 2.5 million members. John Kerry may have lost, he wrote, but the, quote, current leg is just beginning. Now it's our party. We bought it. We own it. And we're going to take it back. Pariser may have been just trying to buck up legions of crestfallen Democrats, but our guest tonight, writer Byron York, says there was a deeper message here. Move On is part of a potent new left-wing network, York says, is changing American politics. The vast left-wing conspiracy, Byron York calls it, and it includes the likes of billionaire George Soros, filmmaker Michael Moore, and think tanks like John Podesta's Center for American Progress, who are arming the left, he says, in whole new ways. America's right wing has long been famous for its far-reaching sway and organization. Now, says York, the left has muscled up. This hour on point, Byron York's picture of the vast left-wing conspiracy. You can join the conversation. Were you impressed by the money, motivation, and organization mustered by the left in the 2004 election? If it was all so potent, as Byron York says, why did the Democrats lose? And are the right and left now equals in the unconventional political organization game? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Byron York, White House correspondent for the Conservative National Review. He's also a columnist for The Hill. His new book is The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, the untold story of how Democratic operatives, eccentric billionaires, liberal activists, and assorted celebrities tried to bring down a president and why they'll try even harder. Next time, Byron York, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you right here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. York.
So, Byron York, are you saying that we've reached now a kind of functional equivalency between right and left in the pursuit of American politics?
Well, I think I would call it more accurately asymmetrical warfare. But as I researched the book and talked to the people who were founding these new organizations, they told me that they quite consciously imitated some of the organizations they'd seen on the left, organizations like the Heritage Foundation, the think tank based here in Washington, talk radio, some political organizations. And there were some differences, I think, that were very clear, though, that the organizations on the right had tended to grow up kind of naturally over the last 40 years since the defeat of Barry Goldwater. And everyone on the left was telling me, we're just trying to do it now, we're trying to do it instantly. And extraordinary amounts, historic amounts of money were poured into it. And it's almost... It muddies up the picture a little bit that it happened during an election year because so much of the money they poured into this effort went to a direct attempt to defeat George W. Bush at the polls, but they were also felt that they were trying to build organizations that would be useful in future elections.
Byron York, let me ask you. You use the word conspiracy, and you note that lots of folks on the left, after Hillary Rodham Clinton first laid that on the right, with the GOP's success, there was muttering on the left in Slate magazine and the New Republic, people talking about needing a vast left-wing conspiracy, a kind of a counterpart to the right's effort. But when you use the word conspiracy, are you saying there's something illegal or secret here or wrong, or is it a another word for organization?
No, I'm not speaking of a criminal conspiracy. I think in one of the lead-ins to this, you referred to the what existed on the right as a fired-up political network, and I think that's probably a better term. Vast left-wing conspiracy has come to be a kind of a shorthand for all of these organizations and people like MoveOn.org, the Democratic 527s, George Soros, Michael Moore, Air America, the Center for American Progress. And they've actually used the phrase quite a bit themselves last month. Al Franken, the radio host, said of his work at Air America, we're just trying to be part of the vast left-wing conspiracy. So this is kind of a shorthand for all the groups we're talking about and not a criminal indictment.
Jack Beatty, we're going to dive into this from a lot of angles tonight. But here's Byron York looking at that whole crowd and saying, together, he quotes, he says, they made up what would become the biggest, richest, and best organized movement in American political history. And yet they lost, Jack.
Yes, they did. But you know, you can turn that around. I mean, he complains that MoveOn.org at 2.5 million people, that isn't impressive next to the amount needed to be elected president. Wait a minute. This is a cadre organization. This is an activist organization. It is not supposed to represent the whole people. And I think that, you know, the fact is John Kerry got 59 million votes, more votes than a Democrat ever. And George Bush had the lowest winning percentage of any president running for incumbent president running for re-election in this century. He's claiming these groups failed. Well, they didn't elect Kerry, but by gosh, they got out the vote.
But
they
you know,
had something to do with
it. They had something. You know, the old saying, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. They didn't win the White House. They didn't win Capitol Hill.
Well, no, but sure. But, you know, to say that because MoveOn.org has only got 2.5 million people in it, and therefore it's small next to what it takes, that's apples and oranges. It's a cadre organization. It's activists. It's like Common Cause or something.
Byron York, in fairness, you're saying, hey, pay attention. These groups are coming on. They may have lost, but they're in business.
That's exactly right. I mean, they failed in their immediate goal of electing John Kerry, but I think John Kerry had a whole lot to do with that. I think he was a pretty bad candidate, and given the conditions that existed in 2004, I don't think that any Democrat was going to win. But I say that these groups should be taken very, very seriously because they have built a big new network.
Byron York, stand by. We're talking tonight about Mr. York's new book, The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy and the Story of the Democrats' Unconventional 2004 Campaign. You can join us tonight. Were you impressed by the way the left organized in 2004 by Move On, George Soros, and Michael Moore? If it was also new and potent, why didn't the Democrats win? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Byron York's new book, The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, and the left-wing's expansive effort to counter the political organization of the American right. You can join the conversation tonight. Are the right and left now equals in the unconventional organization game, in the money game? With all these new approaches, where are politics, right and left, headed in America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Byron York, I wish you'd put some meat on the bones of some of what emerged here. Take us, if you would, to this very interesting evening at George Soros' house that you describe in the book, where a game plan that apparently came from Karl Rove's world was laid before the big international financier.
That's correct. You know, Soros had not been terribly political in the past. Before this last election cycle, I think the most he ever gave was about $100,000 to a Democratic committee, which is not a whole lot of money for him. And after September 11th, he very, very strongly disagreed with George W. Bush's approach to the war on terror and decided that he would do whatever he could to defeat Bush. He hired a group of political consultants and asked them to come up with ways that he could most effectively spend his money in the drive to defeat Bush. And one of the things I do describe in the book was, and I don't think anybody knew it at the time, was that the Democratic consultants had actually come across a copy of Karl Rove's secret voter turnout plan called the 72-Hour Task Force. I never actually found out how they got it. The consultant told me that it had been made, quote, unintentionally available to Democrats. Did that mean they stole it or it was lost by the Republicans or it was leaked? I don't know.
But it was laid before George Soros and it moved the billionaire.
Exactly, but it influenced their thinking, and so they came before Soros in July of 2003 at a meeting at Soros's estate in the Hamptons, and they presented him with this whole plan of how they could effectively boost voter turnout in the next election, and they had brought two people who were forming what would become the biggest Democratic 527, America Coming Together. And before it was over, Soros had pledged a whole lot of money, and some of his friends he had brought did the same thing. And that evening, they pledged $23 million to the effort. Of course, that figure grew enormously as the campaign went on.
I don't know if you have the numbers in front of you, but you've got this kind of half dozen folks, big money folks, around George Soros,
right,
who ended up contributing an enormous amount. Can you run through those figures? Do you have them?
Yes.
At your fingertips, Byron?
Soros spent about $27 million, and this is his own money, not his foundation, which couldn't do that. He spent about $27 million of his own dollars in the effort to defeat Bush. What I discovered was that in this effort, really an enormous part, $78 million, was spent by just five people, and it was Soros and his good friend Peter Lewis, the chairman of Progressive Insurance.
$24 million.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Bing, the Hollywood mogul.
About $14 million.
And a couple in California named Herbert and Marion Sandler, who had founded Golden West Financial. And together they spent $78 million. And to give a little comparison there, the federal government gave the Kerry campaign and the Bush campaign each $75 million, a little less than that, $75 million, to conduct their entire general election campaign. So something really quite new was happening in this last election cycle.
But, of course, there was a lot more than 75 or 78 piled up in total into this campaign on both sides.
The Democratic 527s, as best as we know, spent about $230 million in the effort to defeat Bush. The Republican 527s, Republicans got a much, much later start on this. They actually held their fire on the 527s thinking they would be declared illegal. That turned out not to be correct. And they spent about $85 or $90 million. So on the 527 front, the Democrats had about a 2.5-to-1 edge.
Overall, Republicans had plenty of other money, though.
President Bush raised an enormous amount of money, but he raised it in limited post-McCain Feingold contributions. Obviously, Bush was not the underdog here, but the money did come in different ways because, you know, the real secret of campaign finance reform had been that Democrats were more beholden to seven-figure contributors than Republicans were. Republicans had a larger number of smaller donors. So McCain-Feingold, this is one of the ironies of campaign finance reform, McCain-Feingold hit Democrats much harder, and they knew it. They knew it was coming, and they had to find a way, I think, to keep the big donors in the game, and they relied heavily on the 527s, which allowed them to do that.
Byron New York, you described two kind of prongs to this fork of new organizations, some motivated by anger, some by despair. We should you talked about the Americans coming together and George Soros. Take us through the other planks of this broader left-wing network and who was motivated by which.
Well, what I call the emotional wing, I would put in that category Michael Moore. I would put in that category MoveOn.org, and I would put in that category Al Franken and Air America on some days.
Why emotional?
They were really motivated mostly, I think, by anger. They were angry about the Clinton impeachment. They were angry about the Florida recount, and then this anger sort of transferred to George W. Bush. They certainly became angry about the Iraq War. On the other hand, there was what you might call the professional wing of this, and this was the people who were running America Coming Together. I would also put John Podesta, the former Clinton White House chief of staff who founded the think tank Center for American Progress. Mm. I'd put him in that group too, and they were really motivated more by desperation. And the desperation came from two things. One, this situation that was being created by the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law. They knew it was going to hurt Democrats badly. And the other was the simple realization of how bad the Democratic situation was. Podesta, when I interviewed him for the book, explained to me, he said, you know, Democrats always were operating from some base of power. Even when Democrats lost control of the House and the Senate in 1994, they still, of course, controlled the White House. And when they lost both in 2000, they quickly regained control of the Senate with the defection of Senator Jim Jeffords. And it wasn't until the November 2002 midterm elections that Democrats had to face the fact that they controlled absolutely nothing. And I think that a lot of their action was motivated by these twin realizations that, one of our main sources of financing is about to dry up, and two, we control nothing. So, we really, really need to get on the ball.
And your interpretation of why, after all this money and effort, an attempt to kind of counter the breadth and depth of the Republican sort of greater network, why it didn't work?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One, I think that Kerry wasn't a good candidate, and conditions were not favorable to Democrats. I think the exit polls showed us that the largest number of people voted on the issue of national security, and they trusted Bush. They felt more confidence in Bush than Kerry, or they felt that it was just not safe enough to make a change. On the other hand, I do think another factor I talk about with some of these groups is a certain amount of insularity on their part. And I think you can see that in the world of Move On, where the leaders kept telling themselves and everyone else that they represented the true American majority. And I went to a speech given by Joan Blades, who was one of the co-founders mm-hmm. of Move On. The speech was here in Washington in June of 2004. And she said, you know, I've been saying we could win, but I think it's time we really just came out and said it. We're going to win in a landslide. And there was this kind of self-reinforcing cheerleading that was going on inside. And I think that they didn't really have a good feel for what was actually going on out there in the public.
A kind of closed loop, as you describe it. Jack Beattie, you hear Byron York's interpretation. Of course, he's put it in a provocative way, the vast left-wing conspiracy. There's a tongue-in-cheek piece there, but it's also meat for the National Review crowd, saying it's not the right, it's the left that's got the conspiracy, or at least we're equivalent in any case. But how do you interpret what went on and what it means for the future of American politics, Jack?
Well, I agree with him that this was something new on the Democratic side. He sneers at these statements at the people making it the Move On meeting. Well, this is what people make at pep rallies. What do you want?
We're going to win.
I mean, give them a break. And these groups brought in something new, which was a kind of bounce and youth and vigor. And they were, I don't know whether their views represented a majority or not. But, you look at the polls, and the polls say basically Americans want some kind of abortion rights. Basically, Americans do want everybody to have health insurance. Basically, Americans favor, a clean environment, even if it's sacrificing a certain amount of economic growth, and on and on and on. These are the things that these folks believed in, too.
But you still have to go out and win.
Yeah, well, sure. But as I said, John Kerry was running against an incumbent president in a time of war. We have never unseated an incumbent president in a time of war. And as I say, he did get he got more votes than any Democrat ever. And Bush, of course, is now heading south. He's 43%. So we don't know how. In other words, it wasn't as if, I mean, Kerry wasn't a great candidate, didn't run a great campaign. Yeah. Bush was in a strong position. But these groups, you're tired to argue that they subtracted from his total. I got more stuff from Move. My email would be just full of stuff from them telling me things I didn't know and alerting me as a good citizen, people to call, congressmen. That seems to me to be just what activism is all about.
Byron York, Jack, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from New York, Joshua Michael Marshall. He writes the liberal blog TalkingPointsMemo.com. He's contributing writer for The Washington Monthly, a columnist for The Hill. Joshua Michael Marshall, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You've seen Byron York's book and his interpretation of this broader, more diverse effort on the left in 2004. What do you make of the way Byron York paints it?
Well, whether one calls it a conspiracy or not, I don't know if I would agree to that. There's a sort of in nucleus version of a center left establishment of. Activist groups, of new think tanks, of media outlets, and so forth. It is similar in some ways to what exists on the center right. I think the basic thing, it just hasn't been around anywhere near as long. So I've heard some people say that, that all this money and all this effort went into this, and yet it didn't work in 2004. Well, you know, what the right has in more, you know, in a relatively similar form to what it has right now, goes back almost 30 years, and this has really only been in existence on the Democratic side in the way it is now, really since the 2002 election.
So in terms of tactics, in terms of clout, in terms of a raw desire to win, how would you stack up the big right network and the big left network?
Well, I would say on the diehards on either side, I don't think there's much of a, you know, there's they're both going at light speed in terms of desire to win, so it's a little hard to distinguish the two. I think the difference is there's a reason they call these networks. They have they build constituencies. They not just organize true believers and people who believe in different causes. They expand them. They have think tanks working with media outlets and on and on and on. I don't think the center left, they just don't have that in the way that the right does. I think they've gotten much, much closer in a fairly short period of time. And, you know, the other point to say is that politics is not all about organization. You need good policies. You need a relatively good political moment for your beliefs. And organization is part of that. So, you know, on balance, I think, you know, what Byron is talking about is a very real, you know, it's definitely a reality. Something really, a lot has changed politically in the last couple years. And as someone who is sympathetic to the center left in this country, I was certainly not pleased that President Bush was reelected. But in a medium or long term sense, I have a lot of optimism about what's going on in the center left today in the U.S.
Byron, your sense, everybody's saying tonight that the Republicans have a 30-40 year head start in this kind of approach. Do you see the left playing quick catch up?
Well, they've certainly caught up, I think, faster in a couple of years than any couple of years in the history of the right. Another thing, though, is, and I discussed this with John Podesta about the Center for American Progress. When you talk to someone on the right and then you talk to someone on the left about the relative strengths of the other side, it's as if they're living in parallel universes.
Meaning?
Talk to somebody on the right and say, well, you know how they've got a pretty good machine over there on the left. And they'll say, well, yeah, I mean, they got the New York Times, they got CBS, they got Hollywood, they've got all of academia, they've got huge foundations like Pew and the Johnson Foundation. Then you talk to someone on the left, and they'll say, oh my God, we're just totally outgunned by Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and the Heritage Foundation and SCAFE. So both sides, I think, tend to sometimes overestimate the other's strength. So I do think it's kind of asymmetrical warfare between them. For example, I have a chapter on Air America Radio, which is struggling along now, but in no way presents a rival to the big conservative talk radio stars. So, I think that the left did make a lot of progress in the last couple of years, but it's not as if they didn't have any weapons to begin with.
Jack Beatty, who ultimately wins on the, I mean, conspiracy is a word used very loosely tonight, but it means this larger network. If that's where victory comes from, or the decisive margin, do you see the left pulling abreast the Republicans, or is the asymmetry still a real handicap for the left?
Well, here's the problem for the Democrats. The Republicans are populistically funded. That is just a fact. Maybe not mom and pop, but lots of small givers support the Republican Party. We just heard about $78 million coming from five people. Any party,
for the Democrats.
Yeah, any party that has to rely on these people. And who are they? Who are they? Who elected George Soros? I mean, this guy has, you know, practically smashed the British pound. He did a run on the Bank of England. And, you know, I mean, he's an adventurer, a financial adventurer. And, you know, he has this influence over the Democratic Party. That can't be something that one looks for as a source of stable funding, or even as something that one can. I think Democrats have to regard that as a kind of devil's pact, because who knows what this guy wants. But secondly, look at the opportunity costs here, $78 million. Mm. The Democrats and the liberals don't have an idea. There are no liberal ideas. There are liberal reactions to Republican initiatives. But where are the ideas? Take trade, for example. You know, protectionism has nothing to say to the future. free trade has nothing to say to the present. What's the Democrat? What's there? How are they going to rethink that? If some of this money had actually gone into ideas, into intellectual capital, into the stuff that really makes political movements, I think it would have been much better invested than in this paying people whatever they paid them to go around and talk to voters 10 times.
Josh, Michael Marshall, what do you say?
I think that's, with respect, way off. You cannot, the work of creating systems of ideas for to run a political movement is the decisively important thing. You can't do it in 2 years. So to say this money was misallocated, I just don't think is right. The stuff that went into ideas, you're not going to see the harvest of that that's only going to come in years to come. The other point is, there are George Soros's on the right. I mean,
Richard Mellon's CAFE was mentioned recently here. Yes.
And also the conservative foundations tend to be much more oriented around families than the ones that Byron was saying, Pew or Ford or stuff like that. So while Republican campaigns often have larger numbers of funders, and that's there's a whole separate story there. I just really don't think that's true, that makes the Democrats any different than the Republicans have been for the last 20 years.
Joshua Michael Marshall, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Mr. Marshall of TalkingPointsMemo.com. We're talking tonight with Byron York. His new book is The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Byron York's new book, The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, and the story of the Democrats' unconventional 2004 campaign. You can join the conversation tonight. Does Mr. York have it right? Were the drivers of MoveOn.org and America coming together, were they living in a closed loop that was just too small, out of touch with the American middle? Despite the loss in 2004, is the left structured for a comeback? Has it learned? And are you betting with Karl Rove and Richard Mellon Scaife or John Podesta and George Soros? Is this conspiracy talk the pot calling the kettle black, the right trying to tar the left with conspiracy, or have all politics now changed? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Alyssa's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Alyssa, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I think because of your previous hour and talking about the Christian domination and that whole dominance thing going on with the Christian right, that it's a proper reaction to have the left also kind of build a movement and organize folks. And yes, it might be this conspiracy, but yet I would think that it would be a proper reaction to the Christian domination thing. There needs to be some kind of backlash, so, and it just seems like an appropriate reaction.
So, Alyssa, do you bridle at this vast left-wing conspiracy talk, even tongue-in-cheek, or do you say, right on, let's have it?
Let's have it. We need to have some kind of reaction or action, activating folks who aren't voting and getting them out. I worked for Move On in Pennsylvania, and I just felt like it was a good thing to do to activate folks and get them organized. And the same thing is happening on the right. So I think it is the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, everybody's going to organize, and it might be an unconventional way, with all these emails and our inbox and all of that stuff. But I think it's a needed thing.
But let's pump up the volume and let's go, you say. Alyssa, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call. Ron is calling from Fairfield, New Jersey. Hi, Ron, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I got to partially disagree with Byron and what he's saying about the new surgeons of the Democrat Party. I think they always were good at organizing. But this is their first real trip into organizing the middle class white vote, and I think that's the big difference. Since the white vote is still the majority, what they didn't have is that middle class to vote on their side. And I think what they discovered was that we had a bad president that that fellow Republicans like myself either liked him or disliked him. I didn't love him, but I didn't like the other candidate who happened to be the Manchurian candidate, in my opinion.
So, and what about the Democrats' outreach effort, MoveOn.org, Michael Moore's films, George Soros' money? As a Republican, did that tempt you or drive you off, Ron?
Well, no, it actually drove me to the polls and get family members to the polls because, again, I see Kerry for what he is, which is the Manchurian candidate.
That's a little rough. I mean, he may not have been God's gift to campaigning, but Manchurian candidate?
No, you know, you got someone here that came out of nowhere that suddenly everyone
the United
loved.
States Senate?
Okay. No, but obscurity. I mean, yeah. Come on. You ask somebody 3 years ago, who's John Kerry, they would have no idea. They think you're probably saying John Kennedy improperly.
So you were pushed the other way by the Dems' big effort. Ron, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Let's get one more call here. Robert's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was part of a small group called Swing the Vote. There were only about 100 of us. We had a budget of about $4,000, I think, at the most. And we worked in Cheshire County in New Hampshire, trying to swing where Bush had won by 8,000 votes in 2000. And we worked, I'm an electrician, I've got four kids, I was up there every weekend. We weren't getting billions of dollars from Soros or anything else. We were hand to mouth, going door to door, talking to a lot of people. It energized a lot of us. But I think in the end, Kerry was not a good candidate, but in the end, what we got from people door to door and from some of the colleges we went to was a great deal of fear. Bush was not their candidate, other than they were afraid of what the war and terrorism meant to them. And
You're up against that. But what do you think, Robert, about the larger effort that Byron York's describing here, about George Soros' money, Michael Moore's film, Move On, Act? Did these seem like productive efforts to you? You were out there trying in a less well-funded way, but how about the rest of the picture?
I think it was great. I think it got a lot of people energized. It got a lot of people out. I did get in touch with people from ACT and Move On, and I was really enthused by the number of people that were actually getting out there, going door to door in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and we ended up swinging the vote in New Hampshire in Cheshire County and getting Kerry there.
So you did, Robert, and thanks for your call. Byron York, how about it? The fear factor here with that and incumbency. Jack Beattie says, an incumbent president in time of war hasn't been defeated. So was this vast left-wing apparatus you're describing, was it up against an impossible challenge?
Well, I think it was in 2004. As a matter of fact, what I say about it is I think the impressive thing about it was not that it failed to elect John Kerry single-handedly, but that it built so much in so short a time. Actually, one of your callers was just talking about New Hampshire. Right after the election, MoveOn.org actually took credit for having Kerry cover New Hampshire, which he only did by about 9,100 votes. So where places were close and places like groups like Move On had done big turnout efforts, they made a difference.
Joe's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say, I think I'd like to say to Mr. York what I would have liked to have said to Hillary about the vast right-wing conspiracy, which is just let it go. I think what we're seeing is a well-funded public effort from the Democrats that's really never had a comparable situation in the past. The Democrats have always been, like the grassroots situation, the left. But this time you saw a coalition of far left and middle left coming together as a result of the fear that was generated by George Bush's campaign and George Bush's presidency. And I think it's just it's not a knee-jerk reaction, it's just a reaction. And like somebody was saying about the reactions to the Republicans, in this case, it absolutely was. But they recognized that they had to do something because this was just going in a way that a lot of the country was unhappy with.
And you're saying nothing dark here, just a natural action, reaction. Joe, we've got it. Byron York, the thing that you describe, I guess this is applied to both the right and left here, the conspiracy tag comes in because a lot of this is unconventional. It's just not the way politics have historically been done with the big echo chamber of right-wing radio, with the big money from George Soros, the 527s. You're saying, call it what you want, this is new. It's a new kind of politics.
Oh, absolutely. First, there are some things that were new in 2004 that both sides have adopted very, very quickly. For example, MoveOn.org really showed how much money you could raise and small contributions on the internet. That Move On actually was kind of a split personality group because it did have big contributions from people like Soros and Peter Lewis, but it also got lots and lots of money in small contributions. And Republicans jumped on that very quickly, and I think one of the things that's really not known as much about the last election is Move On and the Democratic Party and America Coming Together would brag quite a bit about the number of email addresses they had, their vast list of people to get out. And not talked about as much was the fact that Republicans had bigger lists. But there were other unconventional things. We haven't talked, for example, about Fahrenheit 9/11. Mm-hmm. And who would have thought that a movie would have played such a big role in a campaign? So there were a lot of things that were different last year.
But Jack Beatty, Byron York digs in there and asserts that Fahrenheit 9/11 wasn't quite the political blockbuster steamroller that it was suggested, that actually, though it was described as playing huge all across the country, really, he says he got into the Hollywood numbers and found it really played big in blue, blue, blue states.
Yeah, overperformed by 80% in San Francisco, underperformed by 50% in Birmingham.
Preaching to the choir.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I think we just heard what American politics really is from Alicia and from Robert. It's people with doing shoe leather, no pay, just going around and talking citizen to citizen. You know, when Barry Goldwater lost in 1964, he got something like 35 million votes. Well, nearly 12 million people were ready to volunteer for his campaign. That's politics. When the Democrats can get a kind of army like that, of people like Robert and Alicia, who say, by God, we're going to go out and change the future, then they will.
Byron York, you say years from now we might well look back on the 2004 election as a turning point in American political history. What do you mean?
Well, I do. One of the things I say in the book is that certainly conservatives are tempted to dismiss some of these people as left-wing nuts, just as some on the left dismiss people on the right as right-wing nuts. But I say I think that you should take it very, very seriously because we did enter a new political world after McCain-Feingold in which money flowed to less accountable organizations, the big 527s that are not as accountable to the public as the political parties are. And now if 527s are reined in, it may go to organizations that are even less accountable that don't even have to reveal who their donors are. We've entered a kind of a new world in which non-accountable, unaccountable organizations are very powerful, as well as a new media world in which both sides are fighting not only on radio, but in movies and other ways. So I do think we could look back on 2004 as being a campaign that was really a harbinger of the future.
You get 527s, you get MoveOn.org, you also get Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. What's your sense, Byron York? Is a healthy evolution for the democratic process? We get just 20 seconds here, or not?
Well, I actually opposed campaign finance reform quite a bit, thought the only thing we needed was instant disclosure. So I think it's been actually a bad thing, and having these outside groups have more power than is not a good thing.
Wherever they come from. Byron York, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Byron York, author of the new book, The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, The Untold Story of How Democratic Operatives, Eccentric Billionaires, Liberal Activists, and Assorted Celebrities Tried to Bring Down a President, and Why They'll Try Even Harder Next Time. Jack, there's a mouthful for a title. Great to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, in a moment, remembering the horrors of Vietnamese re-education camps through art. This is On Point. For Americans, the Vietnam War ended 30 years ago this week with the fall of Saigon. But for the South Vietnamese who fought against the North, the years following the American withdrawal brought humiliation and oppression. South Vietnamese soldiers were forced to enter re-education camps where they were subjected to hard labor and endured horrible living conditions. Quen Trong, a senior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, emigrated from Ho Chi Minh City, then Saigon, to Connecticut 15 years ago. His father spent 7 years in a re-education camp. She had created a series of paintings based on her father's stories of life in the camp. Tonight in this radio diary, Quen Trong talks about how she learned about the difficult period in her father's life.
When I was growing up in Vietnam, I definitely don't remember him telling us any stories. It was just basically not talked about at all. And I think to a great extent, many Vietnamese people in Vietnam still don't discuss the war. They just want to move on from the past and look forward to the future. But when we came to the United States, I think as part of his trying to connect me with the Vietnamese culture and history that I never learned about in Vietnam or in the United States, he would tell me stories. The stories would start coming out. He would just tell me little tidbits of here and there of how he was hungry and starving in these re-education camps. And I didn't know what they were. I thought I was confused and thought, oh, he starved during the Vietnam War. Didn't really understand that there was a separate event that happened after the Vietnam War that he also endured. As I grew older and older and saw that I was moving further and further away from my father, from my family, not understanding my history and the Vietnamese history and where I came from, and I wanted to learn more about the culture and started to think about what it means to have a father who was in the Vietnam War, who had all these stories to tell. So then in Professor Beth Taylor's class, writing the Southeast Asian War, I was asked to interview my parents just to learn from their experiences. So then I really sat down with him and asked what exactly happened. What are the details? He was forced to do basically hard labor, physical labor from sunrise to sunset, just to clear out area so that construction can take place. They were given very little food, and at night they would have to sleep in really crowded quarters. My dad said up to 70 men in a small wooden hut, crammed together like canned sardines. And so that was an image that was really provocative in my mind and inspired me to create one of these paintings. My dad said they'd have a small ball of rice as big as a tangerine. That's all they had to eat every single day. And so because they were so hungry and malnourished, they would scrounge around for food, finding food in local flora and fauna, you know, looking for salamanders and snakes and rats to eat. And also there's the scene of an officer who looks over them. And part of the humiliating aspects of these re-education camps was having officers who were as young as 16 kind of telling them, ordering them around, telling them what to do. He still has family in Vietnam. That's the other side of it. And he has North Vietnamese relatives who fought in the North for the communist government. And when we visited them last summer, actually, it was the first time since I'd gone back to Vietnam since I'd left in 1990. It was an incredible experience because I had no idea that my uncle had fought against my dad, essentially, because my uncle had so warmly welcomed us into his home and because the war is just something that they don't talk about. I think the wounds are healing. They're in the process of healing. So I think my dad himself is still very, has very strong feelings about the subject, but most importantly, he thinks it's important for kids of my generation to remember that it happened not so long ago, 30 years ago, and not to blame people necessarily or to be angry at the current government, but just so that we prevent it from happening again.
Quen Trong is a senior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Her artwork, based on her father's stories of life in a Vietnamese re-education camp, is on exhibit at Brown's Watson Institute for International Studies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.